Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special broadcast on vaccine updates and the cracks in the vaccine paradigm. My panelists include Dr. Andrew Wakefield from Austin, Texas. Dr. Wakefield is a gastroenterologist and academician specializing in inflammatory bowel disease and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or the MMR. He is a former fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons. He has published over 130 original scientific papers and book chapters. In 1998, he and his colleagues at the Royal Free Hospital in London reported a novel inflammatory bowel disease in children with developmental disorders such as autism. Dr. Wakefield resisted pressure to stop his investigations into a possible link between vaccinations, intestinal inflammation, and autism. In 2001, he was awarded the Fellowship of the Royal College of Pathologists, and he has been a board member of the American charity Medical Interventions for Autism. Dr. Wakefield is the co-founder and director of the Autism Media Channel, which airs on various television stations. His website is autismmediachannel.com. His book, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, The Truth Behind the Tragedy, recounts his research into autism, the MMR vaccine, and GI illnesses and his legal struggles by government medical health authorities to discredit him and his work. He will be joined by Dr. Tony Bark. Dr. Bark, a medical doctor, is coming from Evanston, Illinois. She's a pediatric physician and a prestigious homeopathic physician practicing in the Chicago area. She is currently the vice president of the American Institute of Homeopathy, and in addition to her medical degree from Rush Medical College and pediatric internship at New York University, she has degrees in psychology and also from Boston University Medical School and is trained with Dr. Erica Fromm at the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. And she is the author and contributor, along with Mary Holland and Louise Habakus, of the important book, The Vaccine Epidemic. Her website is disease-reversal.com. They are also going to be joined by Dr. Brian Hooker. Dr. Hooker is an associate professor of biology at Simpson University in California, and he specializes in environmental restoration design. As a bioengineer, Dr. Hooker spent 16 years as a team leader for the Department of Energy's Genomes to Life Center for Molecular and Cellular Systems at his Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, where he investigated gene protein networks, cell signaling, and cellular metabolic pathways. He is a prominent leader in the organization Focus Autism, which is investigating the scientific evidence for a vaccine-autism connection. Brian has a teenage son with autism and has been active in the autism community for almost a decade. Over the years, he has filed many Freedom of Information Act requests with federal agencies and received over thousands upon thousands of pages of documents supporting the need to question the efficacy and safety of vaccination. He has been the point independent researcher in the recent whistleblower case with Dr. Thompson from the CDC regarding vaccine dangers. His website is focusautism.org. And our final panelist today will be John Gilmore. John Gilmore is the executive director of the Autism Action Network, a national nonprofit grassroots advocacy organization that influences legislation and public policy on a wide range of issues impacting the autism community, and he has been at this for some time. We'll be going to him last. Let's begin by welcoming our panel, and we're going to start with you, Andrew. Nice to have you with us.
Gary, it's great to be back. Thank you very much.
I'd like to begin with you, since not only are you a physician who has investigated the role of vaccines in the health of children, but you've also been at the harsher end of the pro-vaccine establishment, who admittedly proclaim that vaccines are without question, without doubt, safe and effective. In their worldview, any objection to this tenet is blasphemy. However, increasingly, we see study after study and reports on individual cases of vaccine injury and infectious disease outbreaks among fully vaccinated individuals. So I hope you won't mind me putting you on the hot seat by giving an insight on this, because we have so much information now on vaccines failures. So my question is simple. Should any individual vaccine or combination of multiple vaccines for babies and infants, toddlers, children, be ruled automatically safe and effective because it has been sanctioned by the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease? Should we be allowed or even permitted to question the safety and efficacy, since all physicians, with rare exception, and scientists and public health officials feel that the bedrock of public health is vaccination? The forum is yours.
Two questions there, Gary. I mean, the first question is, are vaccines, any vaccines, as safe and effective as is proclaimed? The answer is absolutely no. We're seeing that at the sharp end with outbreaks of mumps right the way around the world, including now the National Hockey League, outbreaks of measles in highly vaccinated populations, mutations in the forms of pertussis that we're seeing, such that they are escaping the effectiveness of the vaccine. And so rather like the antibiotic paradigm, of what was originally perceived as a great blessing is turning into something of a curse. Should we be allowed to question these things? Absolutely. It was unambiguous that we should have questioned the safety and efficacy of thalidomide, for example, and this is no different. We must, if we are to be vigilant and if we are to avoid this kind of catastrophe that we're in at the moment, we must absolutely ask these questions in a free and unfettered way. And I think we're about to enter, after I've been in this for 20 years, we're about to enter a new arena of this, thanks largely to Brian Hooker, where there is an unraveling, a complete unraveling of an already defunct system, the CDC and the vaccine regulators, with the exposure of what really is going on inside the regulators, organizations, and we're going to find out nearly the dark and dirty truth. And sadly, that will leave a tremendous vacuum where parents are really left wondering who they can possibly trust.
Please give this audience, who may not know of your history, a little background on what happened when you began your investigation in a hospital, along with a large team of very respected gastroenterologists and specialists, looking at symptoms and inflammation in children, and then you wrote your report up. Take us through a summary, a timeline of what happened, and then the consequences, rare that they may be, but they came down on you. The entire media worldwide came against you and your group. Share that with us, please.
It's a very long story, Gary, and I don't want to take away from the very valuable contributions of your other guests. So what I'll just simply say is that in order to silence the vaccine safety work that was done at the Royal Free, that was initiated by the parental history, parental concerns, not parents who were anti-vaccine but took their children to be vaccinated, their children suffered what we are now all too familiar with, and that is regression and onset of acute neurological decline, not just the onset of behavioral symptoms, but seizures, ataxia, and other neurological problems, gastrointestinal issues, systemic disease in the face of a vaccine insult. Turns out, 20 years later, the parents were absolutely right. But the thing that the tragedy for me, and I saw this the other day, Gary, and this really rather sums up the response of the opposition, is that a seventh grade child sent me their documents from school. They had a test which was set which said the truth, the facts about vaccines and autism. And it talked about a study by me at the Royal Free, by eminent physicians, that was apparently entirely fabricated. And this is a poisoning of young minds that has been used in this way, not since the Nazis did it against the Jews. And it is a way of saying to these young people, this is the truth. This is what we tell you is the truth. And if you answer this question in any other way than to give us the answer that we demand, you will fail this exam. What an extraordinary corruption of young minds in this country. Talk about the lack of critical thinking. And those people really need to be called to task. But that reaction is, in a nutshell, Gary, synonymous with what has happened to me and reflects the desperation of the other side in trying to rescue what is an unrescuable program of vaccine mandates.
What I find almost paradoxical is virtually all of the scientists and physicians who were working with you were pro-vaccine, including yourself. And it was only after your findings that you began to question the safety and efficacy of the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, specifically the mumps part. And that is also true with so many other people who are now questioning vaccines. When they stop and look at the total evidence, they ask themselves, why didn't I not see this information earlier? And we're going to explore that in a moment. Please hold on. Let's go over to Dr. Tony Barr. Nice to have you with us. I have been reviewing the many reports and studies regarding vaccines during the past year. And overall, it's been a rather dismal year for the pro-vaccine community and their supporting science. In fact, I would say that the vaccine paradigm, and certainly its science to support its propaganda, is showing serious signs of cracking. For example, the CDC has come out saying that the flu vaccine this year is only 23% effective. There have been an inordinate number of cases of senior citizens dying in assisted care centers shortly after receiving the flu vaccine. An analysis of the CDC's own data, their virus database, reveals over 93,000 adverse events, 8,900 hospitalizations, and over 1,000 deaths associated with the 2013 flu vaccine. The increase in pertussis outbreaks are occurring primarily among the fully vaccinated. The same is true for mumps, as Dr. Wakefield just stated. This year, the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases confirmed the first case of secondary measles transmission after a fully vaccinated woman in New York City infected others. Some who were also fully vaccinated with measles then were the ones coming down. Would you care to speak and address an important new vaccine failure we have witnessed during the past year and provide us with a rationale for understanding why it failed?
Well, I don't think it's new, first of all. I think that there is a concerted effort on the part of the industry and the advisory committees of the CDC and their PR machine to make sure that there's press releases on any outbreaks, whether they're in vaccinated or unvaccinated communities, because they just automatically blame it on the unvaccinated anyway. But if you really compare the number of measles cases that we had, let's say, in 2003 to you know, in the last year, it's not that much different. So I think there's always been failure. As Dr. Poland, who's a big vaccine proponent, you know, he's head of infectious disease over at University of Minnesota, very pro-vaccine man, who he's the one who coined the term the paradox of measles, meaning that in most cases of measles outbreaks, the paradox is that the patients have been fully vaccinated. And so we certainly see a failure in mumps, and in the 479 cases that we saw in one of the southern states last year, three were unvaccinated, and they were latecomers to the outbreak. And, you know, we think we know why that's happening. I mean, in my film, Bought, which I helped co-produce, we interviewed, it was a focus on whistleblowers, and one of the whistleblowers was, we interviewed the lawyer, which it, representing two virologists who were at Merck, who claim that the mumps antibodies for the vaccine were falsified, and that's why we actually see the outbreak is because it was completely falsified. In terms of pertussis, there's a lot of theories, but we know that, one, vaccines wane, the antibodies wane, that's one thing. Two, that vaccine is a vaccine to a bacteria, not a virus, and it doesn't necessarily prevent you from getting the bacteria. It can initially, I think, for us, probably the first year or two, prevent maybe disease from it. However, we see failures even early on, and we do see that there is an antigenic shift in terms of the strains and also between parapertussis as opposed to Bordella pertussis. So it's complicated, and I think that these failures have always happened, and I think you know, it's true that the other side is getting very desperate, which is why they're now pushing for removing all mandates. I mean, the where things are headed right now is that the pro-vaccine industry is pushing to get rid of exemptions completely. That is where they are right now. That is their game plan, and people have to be very vigilant, because if people are asleep at the wheel, this is going to happen state by state, And already, I can tell you, as somebody who has had a private practice for the last 20-something years, you know, in cases where kids came to me and there was a big family history of autoimmunity, I would just write a medical exemption saying there is a strong family history of autoimmunity, and therefore I'm recommending that this child forego vaccination because we're concerned about triggering an autoimmune response. And really, all through the 90s, that was enough in the state of Illinois. And then at the end of the decade, in early 2000, I received a letter from the state saying, well, we want to see if the child had a reaction. Okay, so the child could have a mild reaction, and I could write an exemption that was fine. But in the last 4 years, the letters that have come back that said that the child must have had a documented serious reaction in order for me to write a medical exemption. I mean, think about that for 1 minute. The child has to have a serious documented reaction where they're damaged, you know, not moderate. It has to be a serious reaction where then they would consider medical exemption. I mean, this is just, you know, basically they've taken away medical exemption. You know, it's not up to the individual physicians anymore to do what they feel is best for their patients. It is now, this is how desperate they are, because they're trying to force the hearts and the minds of educated people by basically putting a gun to their head. And that shows that they're desperate.
There's an old Jewish proverb that says a half-truth is a full lie. And when you look at the basis, the foundation upon vaccine implementation, we are told that every vaccine has been proven safe and effective. And one of the ways that this is proven is that it creates antibodies, and the antibodies then are there to protect the body from this antigen, not just then, but in the future. And the big problem for me is that we wanted to put this to the test because I found there was confusion in the entire vaccine field,
yes,
including anti-vaccine people. I would meet with the heads of groups of autism parents. I'd meet with groups of people who had damage, not of autism, but other conditions, and including Gardasil, and the parents and the heads of these groups were still pro-vaccine, but they simply wanted safe vaccines instead of the hot lot bad vaccine that their child unfortunately received. And then I started saying the real numbers of people, not just numbers of people who win in the vaccine court, which is very difficult, and you only win in the vaccine court, which is a very tough court, and there's no appeal to the judgment, if the outside scientists or independent scientists show that, yes, you deserve to. And so it's not a legal decision that determines that your child has been damaged, but it is a scientific decision. And then the legal part is that you are to be compensated because of all the cost of taking care of a kid with autism for the rest of their life. It could be well over $1 million. In any case, one part of government says, yes, there are over 81 cases where people had some form of brain abnormalities caused by the vaccines, and actually stating autism in some. And you have another division of government, the FDA, the CDC, for example, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, saying, no, there is no association. And hence the half lie, where, yes, they can create antibodies, but they haven't proven that they're specific and are always protective. And Robert Louis Stevenson said the cruelest lies are often told in silence. So what I'm looking at is I'm looking at a lot of good doctors and scientists who should know the truth but are staying silent, and I don't know why.
Well, Gary, first of all, look, I trained in a pediatric internship and residency, and I can tell you that you'd think if any group of doctors are trained in vaccination science, if you can call it that, it would be pediatricians, and that's just not the case. And so most physicians, in fact, all physicians, unless they've taken the time to educate themselves, which is quite difficult to do because you have to kind of work through a maze, have no idea how vaccines are made, how they're studied. They think effectiveness means it was actually studied for effectiveness, and that's just not the case. They're, you know, it's studied for an antibody response, and they're allowed to, through that surrogate endpoint, make a claim and extrapolate that out towards it being effective. But in fact, they don't have to prove that it's effective. They just have to show efficacy, which means some antibody response. So physicians don't know how they're made. They don't know how they're studied. They don't know the placebos are not just saline injections. They don't know how the policies are created, that there's advisory committees with conflicts of interest. that they violate the FACA laws. They're clueless, so they really just go along with it. So maybe some physicians see kids get damaged and they think, and this is how I thought, you know, in the 90s, well, you know, vaccines cause injury to some kids. You know, some kids are going to react badly, but for the most part, they're effective. You know, so that's kind of how you get involved. Like, you see a kid who you gave a vaccine to in the afternoon, and then you're running the ER as a resident, and they come in with SIDS or with respiratory distress or in seizure, and you think, wow, we just vaccinated them this afternoon. You know, maybe that was what it was from, and then an attending whispers in your ear, you know, that was a vaccine reaction. So you learn that some kids have these vaccine reactions, but for the most part, they're safe and effective. And so it starts there, and if you don't bother to look deeper, you don't see it, and you really just buy the mantra. And you buy the mantra because you're in the system. And so I think the same with the parents. They were all for it. They just think that their kid had a bad reaction, but that in general they're safe and effective for most people. And so it's a learning process, because we are all raised to believe that vaccines are safe and effective, and they took care of smallpox epidemic, which is not true, and they took care of the polio epidemic, which is not true. But, you know, it's you can see why people believe that, because it's the truism that we're taught.
One final comment before we go over to our next panelist, Brian. In order to complete a series of articles, over 34 articles, our lead scholar in residence, Richard Gale, who has an outstanding background in science and research methodology, as well as others in our office, spent more than 16 months reviewing every scientific article we could find in the world showing and proving the safety and efficacy of a single or multiple vaccines according to the current schedule. What we found was the following. We could not find any quality study based upon a pure double-blind placebo-controlled beginning. There were none. There's no study where you have 1,000 kids that received the vaccine and 1,000 kids that didn't, and you monitor these kids every 4 months for the next 5 years. No such study exists. And then we also found that they were frequently measuring the efficacy of a vaccine based upon another vaccine. And the science was terrible. We also looked at Dr. Jefferson at the famous Italian research, independent research group, the Cochrane Group, and they also concurred on so many vaccines, individual vaccines, that they were not safe or effective. So after we did our homework, which took thousands of hours cumulatively, we wrote a series of articles presenting the evidence and footnoting them, and yet not a ripple, nothing. And then I went on to do the film, and I asked toxicologists, immunologists, who are pro-vaccine, are vaccines safe and effective given any individual? Could you guarantee any individual are going to be protected? And to a person, every single toxicologist, academic toxicologist and immunologist says, no. Well, then why are you for them? Your thoughts on the safety and efficacy of vaccines individually or collectively, guaranteeing their efficacy or safety to any given individual. Tony?
Oh, you're talking to me. I thought you were talking to Dr.
No, Brian's next up.
Oh, Brian. Okay. So if you want to hear my journey is exactly that. So, you know, it was exactly like one of the immunologists said. I would say, if you ask me personally, well, I'm not going to vaccinate. I'm not going to recommend them for my patients or my children, but you know, I want everyone else to get them because they're protecting all of us. And that's kind of where I was. I was like, well, you know, if people want to do them, great, because they're preventing disease. But, you know, I didn't realize that they were failing and that they really altered the way people got disease and that they delayed these diseases so you got them at an older age and that there were no longer exposure in the community to the natural disease that boosted immunity throughout life. So I didn't understand the process. And I don't think, you know, again, I'm going to reiterate that doctors don't learn this. They don't even learn the natural history of infectious disease, of these infectious diseases. In fact, I don't even think infectious disease fellows learn the normal natural history of mumps and pertussis and measles and chicken pox and how it's important to have them at a certain age and then every 10, 20 years as your immunity is waning to be exposed to the next generation because it boosts your immunity and it prevents certain diseases down the road. You know, that is lost now. I don't think that's being taught in the curriculum. And that is something that unless you take an initiative as a physician to go out of the sphere that you're in and you're bucking the system and you start learning, that you're not going to know any of it. The research is there. The published studies are there. The journals from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s are there. But it's not something that you're going to be, that anyone's going to bother to educate you about in your training program. And so it is, has to be an individual journey for physicians because they certainly aren't going to hear about it. And on the contrary, they're going to hear that the moment you question, you're a quack. The moment you question, you know, and I posted tonight, you know, questioning vaccines is like questioning the prophet for Islamic radicals. I mean, you just can't do it. It is like the one thing you aren't allowed to whisper in public. You know, it's all right to question the use of antibiotics, the overuse of antibiotics, the use of statins, the use of antidepressants, but the moment you start questioning the use and the safety and the effectiveness of vaccines, it is, you have crossed a line and you are now thrown into the bin of quackery. And which is interesting because quackery, you know, is based on quicksilver, which is mercury, and really, you know, that's the problem with a lot of the old vaccines and certainly the flu vaccine. So it's understandable to me. I understand why most physicians and most parents, even with vaccine-injured kids, don't say they're against all vaccines or the concept of vaccines, or they just want vaccines to be safer. For many of them, they believe that, and for many of them, they're afraid to say the truth, that they're not going to go listen to if they actually say the truth, which is, you know, no, I've looked carefully, and I don't think there are any safe and effective vaccines right now. I think that I can understand it.
Okay. Tony Bark, B-A-R-K, from Evanston, Illinois. Please hold on. Let's now go over and say hello to Dr. Brian Hooker. Nice to have you with us today, Brian.
Thank you so much, Dr. Null. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Earlier this year, there was a startling revelation from a medical official at the CDC, Dr. William Thompson, coming forward with information and data that the CDC covered up the high autism rate among African-American boys receiving the MMR vaccine. Now, although Dr. Thompson has been very low-key since he made his information public, there is still other information he shared with you that has not been made public yet. For example, the relationship between what is known as the isolated autism and the MMR vaccine. So would you please explain this relationship to our audience, and what is the isolated autism and how might it be triggered by vaccines?
Well, when you look at autism cases in general, autism many times is a disorder that has what's called a comorbidity with it. And the CDC, back in 2004, when they were looking at the effects of MMR and autism, this is the same study that when I reanalyzed the data, I saw a much higher risk of autism in African American MMR males that got the MMR on time. But they also looked at this phenomenon called isolated autism, and these were children that had not previously received any type of congenital deformity diagnosis or any type of visual impairment, any type of hearing impairment, or any type of mental retardation up to age one. And when those data were analyzed, when the isolated autism cases were looked at against match controls, we saw astronomical risks, and the CDC, likewise, 10 years ago, saw astronomical risks that those children were 2.8 times more likely that received the MMR on time were more likely to have what's called isolated autism versus those individuals where they delayed the MMR vaccine after 36 months.
Hmm. What other information can you share with us about Dr. Thompson, what the documents he gave out to the legislator? You're privy to some of that information. And what is Dr. Thompson's current position? Since he has not chosen to come forward, has he gone back into the acceptance of the medical paradigm at the CDC, or is he going to be a whistleblower?
He is back in the CDC, and as far as I can tell, he is still a government whistleblower. He is still has whistleblower protection. I have to apologize. I haven't personally been in contact with Dr. Thompson for quite some time. I have talked to him through his attorney, but from what I understand, he is still cooperating with congressional officials. And, you know, the documentation that's been shared, some has been shared with me, more of it has been shared with congressional representatives. You know, we're not talking about smoking gum, we're talking about wildfire and cases where CDC officials have denied, lied, and we have a vaccine safety system in the United States that's absolutely in shambles.
Could you give the audience who's not familiar with Dr. Thompson's revelations why his revelation is so important and how, and this is very important, his statements, based upon the study at the time it was done, could have exonerated Dr. Wakefield and his colleagues from being attacked by Anderson Cooper and others in the field?
Well, Dr. Thompson is a distinguished epidemiologist. He started at the CDC in 1998, and he has had a PhD in psychology from the University of Virginia with an emphasis on epidemiology and statistics. He worked for Merck before he worked at the CDC, and he is, you know, was and is an outstanding scientist in his field. Dr. Thompson is one of the few individuals at the CDC that actually has a conscience, and when the relationship between the MMR vaccine and autism, which we see a relationship not only in African-American males but also in this phenomenon that I called isolated autism, when that information came out, and this came out as early as 2001, he went directly to his superiors, the co-authors of the paper, one who is now a center director for the CDC, one who is now the head of the Immunization Safety Office of the CDC, and they told him that he was to bury that particular association, and they looked for statistical methods in order to hide that particular association. If that association had not been hidden, if it had been released to the light of day, if it had been published in the journal Pediatrics, when the fraudulent article was published, then all this happened before the GMC hearing for Dr. Wakefield. It would have shown that there was a relationship, that was there was an epidemiological basis for a relationship between the MMR and autism, and it very well could have exonerated Dr. Wakefield.
One final question at this time. Brian, I understand that you have some new information to share about ethyl mercury or thimerosal that is still used in some vaccines, such as the flu vaccine, at 24 micrograms, which is a substantial dose. Could you share that, please?
Yes, Dr. Null. The thing that weighs on me is the fact that the majority of the flu shots that are given to pregnant women in the United States contain that 24 micrograms of thimerosal. Actually, it's 24 micrograms of ethyl mercury, which is 50 micrograms of thimerosal. That is well past the EPA safe limits, not only for the pregnant woman, but for the developing fetus. And the CDC has hid, and this was elucidated in part by Dr. Thompson, elucidated also by documents that I received by the Freedom of Information Act, that children that receive that that shot in utero, that receive that exposure in utero, are about eight times more likely to regress into autism. And that's another relationship that was buried, that was hidden. You can go to the original report. It's a 500-page report, and you'll see one data point. that shows where that relationship is. But that was buried. When the final publication, this publication was co-authored by Dr. Thompson and also a gentleman by the name of Christopher Price, when it came out in 2010, that data point and that information was nowhere to be found. And instead, it's the party line and what the publication actually said was that there was no relationship between prenatal thimerosal exposure and autism. So it's a flat-out lie.
That was a cover-up and a lie.
That is correct.
Okay. Brian, please hold on there. Let us go back to Dr. Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield, you may have seen the 12-year study released about 10 days ago by the Kaiser Permanente Vaccine Study Center that claims parents of children 1 to 2 year old should not worry about the serious neurological and blood and immune system adverse effects from the measles vaccine and MRI, or MMR. And this study comes right on the heels of the measles outbreak in Disneyland and the mass media outcry against unvaccinated children. And sometimes the synchronicity of these kind of events, followed by a quick release of a study to support a certain policy or agenda, are too much to believe. Do you have any thoughts on how this Kaiser study or any other new information regarding the measles vaccine and its relationship to autism or health conditions associated with autism to share with us?
Well, my role at the moment, Gary, is as a filmmaker. And as you mentioned earlier, and on the back of our first documentary, Who Killed Alex Bordalakis, we're now working with Brian to produce Feast of Consequences, which is the story of the CDC whistleblower. And it opens with the HHS's definition of research fraud. Falsification in science includes omitting data or results such the research is not accurately represented in the research record. Many people have said, well, Dr. Thompson hasn't admitted to fraud and he still supports vaccination. And this is sort of what is put out there by the alternative opinions on this. And then you read Dr. Thompson's statement, I regret that my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article published by the Journal of Pediatrics. There is unambiguous admission of fraud, and that is why this has got to be investigated at the federal level. There is absolutely no question. There is no out. This has got to be investigated by Congress, and these people have got to be held accountable. And if, as we believe, they are guilty of fraud, they must go to prison. And that is the way this will change. When there is personal accountability for what has gone on, it is absolutely extraordinary that we've got into this situation and the hypocrisy of those agencies that are there to protect the lives of American children, to cover this up and to allow thousands and thousands of children to go to the wall to develop permanent neurological injury. The idea that that might be mitigated or there may be some sort of public relations exercise to mitigate that is so cynical as to be almost unbelievable.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you. Let us bring on now John Gilmore. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you, Dr. Null.
It now seems very evident to me that the pro-vaccine establishment and all the physicians and scientists that they have running around the country, appearing on television with absolute certainty, but never in a debate with Dr. Wakefield, never in a debate with Dr. Bart, or the other people that are out there who could easily defend Ryan Hooker, for example, could defend the science challenging the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. They're always alone. It's more like a PR stump. But they also, in my opinion, are losing scientific credibility in their efforts to persuade parents who already exempt their children from vaccination. And therefore, their only real effective recourse is to change the laws, as Dr. Bark said earlier in the program, that would force parents against their will to vaccinate their children or suffer the consequences, removal of the child by social services, and label the parent a bad parent, even though that parent may be a physician who is so knowledgeable about the dangers of vaccines and the lack of efficacy of vaccines, they would never dream of vaccinating their children. And now that the doctor's in trouble and the children are taken away, it's possible. So rates of autism and other neurological disorders are now not abated and continue to increase annually. I don't think any of the educated parents who refuse vaccination would disagree that other environmental factors are also contributing to autism epidemic, and not solely due to vaccines. And, of course, there's absolutely no science whatsoever in the possible synergistic effects between vaccine ingredients and other environmental toxins that have been implicated in autism. And the two primary weapons the pro-vaccine establishment has, one is to remove non-medical-based vaccine exemptions or the religious and philosophical objections from the state law books, and the second is to force mandatory vaccination by establishing punishments for failure to comply, even loss of a job or no entry into school. So please speak and take your time and update us on the efforts at the national level to eliminate non-medical vaccine exemptions and then the strategies for pushing forward mandatory vaccines.
Well, thank you. There's a lot going on, and I tend to be an optimist. There are these ferocious battles going on. If you pay attention only to the mainstream media, you would come to the conclusion that there's a small group of crazy people out there who are questioning the vaccine program. And when you really look at it, it's far from it. It really seems that the vaccine industry is starting to lose the war for the hearts and minds of the American public. There was a really interesting poll that came out earlier in the year that was released by the, I believe it's called the National Consumers Council. And it's an odd poll that they took because it's a very involved look at people's opinions about vaccines and the side effects of vaccines and whether they cause autism and so on and so forth. And one can only conclude that the vaccine industry is losing ground and losing ground rapidly. There were some statistics published from that, and we made some phone calls and some inquiries. We got some deep level of information there. And it would seem that based on this poll, again, paid for by the vaccine industry, that at least 40% of women of childbearing age in the United States believe at this point that at least vaccines can cause autism. That's a disaster there for the vaccine industry. And there is a great deal of pushback from the public. People are educating themselves, and they're doing something about it. And as a consequence, as you pointed out, the vaccine industry is trying to basically compel people to vaccinate their children or to vaccinate themselves if they have a variety of jobs in the health industry and so on. And it doesn't seem like it's going that well for the other side. The big change has gone on. I work for the Autism Action Network, and one of the key things that we do is try and organize grassroots opposition to expansion of the vaccine program, to additional mandates, and to limit people's choices to make health decisions for themselves and their children. And we've been doing this since 2005. And what seems to be going on, from my perspective, is that the effort to use state legislatures, who traditionally has been the arena in which these decisions have been made, to add new shots to the schedule and to put up various barriers to people exercising their rights to choose, isn't going very well. Basically, they kind of reached their high point with the HPV vaccine. A few years ago, I'm sure you're quite familiar with that. They tried to make it mandatory everywhere in the United States, and they failed miserably. And since then, the effort to try and get additional vaccines through state legislatures who have to pass a law and use a democratic process and have a governor sign in a new law isn't working. There's instance after instance where they try and they fail. They try and they fail. They try and they fail. They have complete support from the mainstream media, yet they're still failing, right? And that's because there's this huge growing resistance to what they're trying to do. And just in the last year, and I think Dr. Thompson's revelation has a lot to do with this, we have seen a change in tactics with the vaccine industry. Okay, number one, we are seeing an upsurge of what is frequently called astroturf activism. You have public relations firms and lobbying firms that represent the vaccine industries who push money out there to create the appearance of popular support for various corporate agendas. That's one aspect of it. That's really new. But what we've also seen is that in the last year particularly, the vaccine industry seems to have given up on trying to get elected officials to do their bidding, right? We don't see the laws coming forward. If we see the laws coming forward, there is very clear sort of legislative barriers that will prevent them from getting going forward. And what we do see, however, is that the vaccine industry is more and more relying on executive orders produced by appointed bodies. They're basically given up on people who have to respond to the democratic process and going to appointed officials to try and do this. We've seen, I live in New York, we've seen this in New York City, we've seen it in New York State, we've seen it in Rhode Island, we've seen it in Ohio, we've seen it in Michigan, and a variety of other states. And, this presents us with challenges, but I'm actually very encouraged by it, okay, because they are surrendering the legislative ground. They don't think they can win there anymore. So this sort of grassroots education and organization that we are doing, that you are doing, that Dr. Hooker is doing, that Dr. Wakefield is doing, is producing real, tangible results. Right? And so I think what you're going to see going forward is increased efforts to sort of overturn these efforts through non-democratic governmental institutions to try and limit their rights. And we're doing a lot of organizing around this. Other groups are doing organizing around this. And I think collectively we are definitely moving in a positive direction, if you consider positive to being allowing people to make decisions for themselves, for making decisions for their children, their own children, about the health care they get.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. Tony, we're wrapping up our program. A short answer on this.
Sure.
Do you see more scientists or physicians coming forward to look at the evidence and then to make some statements in support of those who have been injured, and the likely outcome of 50% of all children in the next 20 years ending up with autism because of environmental exposures, not the least of which are the contaminants and adjuvants in these vaccines?
I think there's more and more scientists and people in the legal community and in the research community who are coming forward. I mean, every day the email groups that I'm on, the newsletters are growing by leaps and bounds of with physicians and researchers who are in the mainstream who are coming over to our side because they have seen the evidence, and it's growing rapidly. So I am, I'm encouraged because of that, but I do agree with everything that the former speaker just said, which is that, the industry at BEP is using executive powers, and that's the scary part. But yes, I do think that people are coming over on looking at this. Really, it's a wave. It's a tidal wave, and it's moving quickly.
We're finishing up with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Do you believe that there will be enough evidence coming forward that you could completely exonerate your name within the scientific community, and by extension, the major media challenge them to tell the truth by looking at the evidence that you and your colleagues did nothing wrong, that you were actually telling the truth, and Dr. Thompson's work at the time supported that truth, and yet they covered it up with malice aforethought?
It's very kind of you to discuss it, Gary, but it's not actually the important point, and I appreciate you raising it, but personal exoneration is far less important than saving this nation's children from what is a horror story at the moment. And if in the process of the correct science being done, the true story coming forward, that my colleagues and I are by proxy exonerated, then I'd be delighted. But the issue is far, far bigger than just me and my colleagues. We all know that. And in fact, if we get carried along in the wave, well, that's great. In fact, it's our job to try and make that wave, not for ourselves, but for the children of the world. So I can live with the ignominy. That's not a problem. But I can't live with is seeing another child damaged by vaccines.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you have continued to be concerned. It is a larger issue, but let us not also forget that by vilifying you, a person who has strong moral character, great scientific background, outstanding physician, it sends a lesson to lesser individuals within the field that there is a risk and a loss if you come forward and tell the truth, if that truth hurts the establishment. So that's one of the reasons I want to see the truth come out about you. And I thank you all for being with us today. We're at the end of our program. Dr. Andrew Wakefield from Austin, Texas. Dr. Tony Bark from Evanston, Illinois. Dr. Brian Hooker from Redding, California. And John Gilmore from Long Beach, New York. Thank you all for being with us. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening.